Would you like more InDefensive Plants each month? Well, you're in luck. Starting this month, InDefensive Plants is now offering bonus mini-episodes over at our Patreon page. To find out how you can gain access to this bonus botanical content, head on over to patreon.com/indefensiveplants and consider becoming a patron. And as always, thank you for your continued support of InDefensive Plants. Together, we are helping cure plant blindness around the world, one episode at a time.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the InDefensive Plants podcast, the official podcast of InDefensivePlants.com. What's up? This is your host, Matt. Welcome to the show. How's everyone doing this week? That's right. From this point moving forward, I will be offering mini bonus episodes, at least two a month. So head on over to patreon.com/indefensiveplants and check that out. If you're already a patron at the $5 or more level, you are immediately added to this list so you can go and access the first one today. If not, again, please consider becoming a patron because your contribution helps make InDefensive Plants what it is, and I couldn't be doing it without you. But in the interest of today's episode, you remember back on episode 227 that we went in search of the so-called stinking cedar, Terea taxifolia. It's an extremely endangered tree endemic to the southeastern United States. Well, my guest today is someone working very hard on the conservation practices surrounding this species. Joining us is Jennifer Seska. She's the conservation coordinator for the State Botanical Garden of Georgia in Athens, and she's involved in conservation networking, so what it takes to get every player in the same room talking about saving a species from the brink of extinction. Conservation networking is extremely important because no one can do it alone. This is a group effort, and we all have to rally behind these sorts of efforts to make it possible to save plant species. This is all part of the Georgia Plant Conservation Alliance, but I don't want to steal any of her thunder because it's incredible work that's being done, and it offers a ray of hope in what is usually a dismal story of extinction on this planet. So, without further ado, here's my conversation with Jennifer Seska. I hope you enjoy. All right, Jennifer Seska, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. How about you tell everyone a little bit about who you are and what it is you do?
Hey, Matt. I am Jennifer Seska, conservation coordinator at the State Botanical Garden of Georgia in Athens, Georgia. It's part of the University of Georgia. My main work is involved in conservation networking, bringing together amazing people to do beautiful work on behalf of critically imperiled plant populations, coordinating the Georgia Plant Conservation Alliance.
This is great, and I'm super excited to have you on the podcast, but I'm curious, what brought you to where you are today? Were you kind of always a plant person, or is it something you kind of figured out later on down the road throughout your education or career?
Yes. In hindsight, perhaps I was always a plant person. Growing up in Texas and important icons of blue bonnets and growing up in Grand Prairie and having a small prairie behind our school. But no, I was an animal behavior major at Florida State. I was a nationally ranked synchronized swimmer. Whoa. And I had visions of working at SeaWorld. And my last semester at Florida State, I took Lauren Anderson's field botany class and fell in love. And I applied to graduate school at UGA. And the same few weeks that was happening, I got an offer from SeaWorld San Antonio.
Oh.
That was a tough crossroads.
Yeah.
But I chose grad school at University of Georgia Athens and I got a degree in horticulture. I wanted to do something really applied and wanted to do conservation biology through horticulture.
Wow, what a journey.
Yes, yes, it worked out beautifully. And perhaps angels were whispering. I might have gotten squished by a sad whale or something.
Oh, no.
But I still have dreams of what that could have been.
Sure, sure. And I'm sure that comes with any major life decision at any point in time. But, you know, I think it's really good for the plant's sake of things that you found this trajectory because you're doing extremely important work.
Thank you. That's very kind.
Yeah.
Yes. I do. I have my dream job. I got it out of grad school, and I've been in the same position ever since, building a program with my colleagues. I love the people I work with, and I love what we do. Yeah, I'm real proud of what we do.
Wonderful. Well, how about we get an overview of what it is that the Georgia Plant Conservation Alliance does and then like your role in the whole situation?
Sure. So I'm essentially the spider in the web, and my role is to connect people and lift them up and figure out ways to help people get work done or to share or share expertise, share resources, show up for a work party. And we started in 1995. It was a small group. It's the Georgia Plant Conservation Alliance is a professional organization. There are no dues, no parliamentary procedure. We meet 3 times a year. We are plant project driven, and our goal is to talk about projects when we get together. And we started with, 7 organizations, and now there's 54.
Whoa.
And we started with 3 gardens that had horticulture capacity on behalf of critically rare plants and growing them for safeguarding. And now we have 11 partners and recently had many more botanic gardens in Georgia, small historic gardens, step forward and say, how can we help? So we're expanding our horticulture capacity, hopefully this next year, and getting those partners growing more safeguarding collections, just in case, to have those extra plants, indexed material grown by partners and held to protect populations in the wild.
Wow, that is excellent. And it's really exciting to hear this idea of project-driven work, because a lot of times, sometimes these goals can be nebulous or just, you know, nice in theory, but in practice, what does that even mean kind of deal? But to see this sort of project-focused idea that getting hands in the dirt, so to speak, and getting things in the ground and just working towards something tangible that is, you know, safeguarding things in the long run. And then this other side is this idea of collections. You know, I think places like Europe, which have a much more ingrained horticultural history into them, have this celebration of national collections of different plant species. And that could largely be focused on horticultural varieties and such. But it sounds like this focus really is on, like you said, safeguarding plant populations, native plant species, in these sort of ex situ or even in situ collections that you, like you said, safeguard more plants, these physical entities that we do, you know, have to remember that they're the goal of all of this conservation work.
That's right. That's right. And so from the beginning, everyone was adamant that we not have many meetings, that we get together and talk what we're going to do that calendar year and then report back by the end of the year, and not in a way that tears people down if something doesn't get done, but in a way that says, what can we do next year to help make that happen? Hmm. Or is it just too much right now and we'll table it, or what's next? But the ideas of the safeguarding collections for us, of course, came from the Center for Plant Conservation. So we were not members of the Center for Plant Conservation back then, but we modeled our work after partner gardens that were doing that and learned from them, and shared our notes and collection information with the CPC headquarters, just out of sense of professionalism, sense of that's the right thing to do.
Right.
And they were so great and collaborative, working early days with Kay Havens when she was at Missouri Botanic Garden, working for Center for Plant Conservation. So that's where that came from. And the Atlanta Botanical Garden had amazing collections, and we were newer to safeguarding collections back in 95, and we've built ours since then and have learned a lot of our horticulture capacity expertise through our brothers and sisters at the Atlanta Botanical Garden, particularly Ron Dieterman.
Ron. An icon of what it means to be a plant-based human. I mean, that is just the epitome of growing and just charisma on top of that. He's one of the most unintentionally hilarious people I've ever had the chance to talk with.
Isn't that the truth? And, you know, he's trained so many of us up. I met him when I worked in the admissions booth at the Atlanta Botanical Garden before I went to grad school. And he's been mentoring me ever since, and then all of us. Since then, generations of conservation biologists have been trained up by him. He's been very generous. He's like, come work with me for a day. I'll show you how I do this. And always so quick to share his expertise, thinking that it was for the applied good. Yeah, he's been great. And he is hilarious.
Yes, indeed. But again, this idea of applied, and that's what really gets me excited. And being in academia right now, it just hurts me to the core whenever I hear a scientist sort of scoff at applied science, because we're getting nowhere unless we start embracing more and more applied science. And that's, again, coming back to this sort of hands in the dirt, getting things planted and just doing something for these plants, collecting, storing, growing, that sort of thing. It's so vital to plant conservation that these things do get applied at some point.
No, I agree. You know, and we've had such good guidelines from the Center for Plant Conservation, right? And Botanic Gardens Conservation International and the scientific literature in general. We know the safe, proper guidelines on seed collecting and ethics, and we might as well try. People in my early career, not in Georgia, but partners were hesitant to try to outplant an endangered species unless they had 500 to do a replicated study and plots. And I just appreciated Ron's perspective, thinking, you know, we've got 50 plants. It's taken us 5 years to build up 50 of these plants. Let's plant half of them out and see if we can even get them to stick, right, to root, to live a year. And that intelligent tinkering, tracking what we did, how we did it, what worked, what didn't, and just keep tinkering with it until we could figure out the right microsite for getting plants to live a year on their own. And then increasing the numbers in the outplanting population. We would like to do it the other way with 500 plants in a replicated study. But for so many of these species that we work on, the horticulture is taking so long. The plants are in such decline. We're starting out with 8 seeds from the last plant of one population. And we just felt the need to start trying and learning from that. And it has built. And I think we hit it the nick of time. I really do believe we would have lost some Georgia populations to extinction if we had not moved on these activities and gotten a little aggressive and moving forward.
Definitely. Yeah. And I mean, that's life, right? There's always plenty of room for idealism, and there should be 500 plants of everything, right? But the reality of the situation is, like you just so wonderfully outlined, is like so often that is so not possible or takes way too much time that if you waited for those perfect scenarios to arise, these things would be gone forever.
That's right. So with that, though, you know, we write it down, we document it, we share it with our partners, we have all the landowner permissions, you know, it's tracked, it's documented, right. It's part of a plan.
Yeah.
But we do try to get plants in, and we start with partners in protected lands if we can.
Yeah, that's exactly, I mean, it's beautiful because it does have to have a scientific base or at least some sort of data-driven effort there, because you, like you said, you have to learn, even if there's mistakes made, you have to learn from them.
Yes. We've killed a lot of plants, right?
Yeah.
So you kill a lot of plants learning how to grow critically imperiled plant species. It's part of it.
Yeah.
And again, you know, someone hands you 8 seeds, you say all the prayers and do your best and try. But if you don't try, what's the option? So,
right.
Yes, we use all the tools in the tool bank. You know, we seed bank, we propagate, we do cryopreservation, in vitro horticulture, propagation. We try it all. We try. Yep. We use all the tools and tricks. But just trying to keep these things moving forward through time.
Yeah, I mean, show me a plant grower that hasn't killed some plants along the way, and I'll show you a liar.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
So the reason we connected was because of this plant called the Torreya.
Yes.
What is this tree for anyone that is not familiar with it?
It is one of the world's most critically endangered conifers. It was our very first Georgia plant conservation project in 1995. I know. So it looks like, well, right now it looks like a Charlie Brown Christmas tree. You know, the kind where you put the ornament on and it bends in half.
Yeah.
Yes. It's a beautiful, very sharply needled Christmas tree looking tree. And sometimes when we show children, they say, oh, that's plastic. That's not real. But then we do a little more exploring. Yeah, the branches are whorled, and you can early decades count their whorls to age the trees.
Okay.
Sort of, except that they tend to die back to the roots and then resprout. So maybe you're counting the age of the resprouts is what you're
I see.
It grows in extreme South Georgia and North Florida. And if you grew up in Chattahoochee, Florida, you hung out at the IGA on Friday nights. if you were in high school, you do. I've done that with some beautiful people.
Oh, for sure.
And you used Turaya as your fence post. You probably used it as your mailbox poles. And you may have used some harvested little seedlings for your Christmas trees. It was so common in that area. It was, pines, southern magnolia, and Turayas growing. And the Turayas were growing in the ravines along the Chattahoochee River.
Wow.
Yes.
I had no idea they were that abundant at one time.
Talking to locals, they all knew Turaya. It was just there. It was one of those things. It's so abundant. You know, we're not worried about it. It's like with Red Bay. When the Red Bay wilt came, we're like, who grows Red Bay? It's so common.
Right.
But then the Red Bay wilt beetle came and took them all out for a sweep. And we think, oh, Lord, we don't have this going in any kind of backup collection. So Turaya was just so common until it wasn't. Until it started crashing like falling giants, I guess, in the 50s and 60s.
Jeez. So, I mean, this was something that was common until our lifetimes, right? People listening today could probably have remembered, if they grew up in that area, a time in which it wasn't in decline.
That's right. That's exactly right.
That's super troubling, because look at the landscape today and how quickly everything is changing. And again, you know, we tend to wait until things are in a bad place to start going, oh, yeah, we should probably care about that. But this is such a good illustration of the fact that, like, commonness and rarity are just snapshots in time, and you don't know what the future holds. So, again, this sort of holistic approach to conservation kind of rings true throughout these lessons that have been learned.
I've really appreciated the leadership and the work with Save Our Seeds and the National Seed Strategy, thinking of collecting, at least, like you said, it's not ideal, but at least getting started, maybe three populations across the range of a common species, you know, just to get something in a seed bank, just in case, for emergency backup. I appreciate that. So we've changed our phrasing about what we do. We work to keep the critically imperiled species from winking out, and we work to keep the common species common. And we've been led there, I think, in the last 15 years.
Wow. Well, that's a refreshing trajectory to hear. So what happened to the Turaya? Why did it crash, like you said, like giants falling?
I know. It is a curious story. So it's anecdotal, but amazing scientists like Angus Golson and Mark Schwartz and Sharon Herman, the work of Tall Timbers, they started piecing together hypotheses on this and published many papers on it. So the adult trees were crashing from the roots. They were falling like, you know, somebody's calling timber and the trees falling from just bottoms up. So they thought it was some sort of root fungus, some sort of disease. And they hypothesized about why this disease suddenly showed in the 50s and 60s and thought perhaps it was due to changes in the environment. So early days, the story we told was there were, I don't even know, 4 or 5 paper mills put up in the area, possibly changing soil chemistry, acid rain situations, possibly making the trees weaker and more susceptible to a fungus that was in the soil. Or maybe it was an introduced pathogen, but they became weaker horticulturally, so that became suddenly susceptible. They said things in their habitat changed, like the tops of the ravines where the trees were harvested, creating more sunlight, and perhaps that stressed the trees, and maybe reduced water stressed the trees. But this was all anecdotal and lots of tinkering and monitoring and trying to figure out. I heard stories of 3 different professional pathology teams trying to figure out what the disease was. So when we got involved in 95, I think it was my very first presentation on behalf of the Georgia Plant Conservation was a conference on Turaya at Tall Timbers down in Tallahassee, Florida. And we asked their blessing, their permission, that this being the horticulturist, the conservation biologist, the ecologist, there's probably 40 people in the room. We thought we were taking the Turaya away from the disease. So we were modeling the work of the Center for Plant Conservation. Let's create safeguarding collections at botanical gardens. And then we asked if we could put indexed collections, plant populations of Turaya away from the disease, and plant them at institutions in public spaces like Callaway Gardens, State Botanical Garden, Atlanta Botanical Garden, Chattahoochee Nature Center. And we planted them at Smith Gallwood State Park in their common area. Georgia Southern Botanical Garden. We planted these groves of trays, separating each site different populations. We had to present this case to the Tall Timbers colleagues mm-hmm. because it was a big deal taking a species out of its range.
Yeah, for sure.
And it wasn't an easy yes. We discussed it passionately, and there were criteria that we would always track them, annually monitor them, have a signed agreement that we would do this ongoing. The institution would sign on that it would monitor forever, amen, and that we would plant them in cultivated areas, not in wild sites.
Okay.
That was the agreement we made because we knew so little back then
right.
about really what was going on. And of course, perhaps this is a segue, I'm not sure, but the story changed once we got more science in there.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing to think that so much of this early on was just going like, oh, what could have happened? And like you said, it's anecdotal sort of speculation, but speculation with, you know, proper insights into what this tree kind of needs. But to think of, you know, mid to early 90s to late 90s, what was going on and how these conversations were kind of happening on a small scale compared to what it is today. I mean, that's an impressive effort to undertake and just to kind of commit yourselves to not only just, like you said, trying to find these ex situ collection areas that you could put them in, but then the upkeep and the monitoring and just to figure out what was going on. But as you said, the story has changed. So what did you learn from those early days?
Of course, anytime we bring a species into collection and we grow it, we learn so much about its life history or its potential life history. How can we make the species thrive in cultivation? And then can we apply those techniques to the wild site? We find that it likes afternoon shade. And so perhaps we need to make sure it's getting some sunlight in those ravines, but definitely afternoon shade. It is remarkably drought tolerant once established. Can we make sure that that the hydrology is such that that is possibly happening in the wild? So we partners, particularly led by Callaway Gardens and the Atlanta Botanical Garden on this part, but applying horticulture techniques ex situ, but then also in situ to see if we could make these trees thrive. They tried different fertilizing regimes. They tried different soil pH amendments in outplantings, not in original wild trees necessarily. Just try different techniques and to get the trees to thrive. And still they limped along. So that was early days, trying through horticulture capacity to apply what we learned to help the trees thrive in the wild. Still didn't go real well, but we did. This is actually a big deal. So the trees did not cone in the wild, or very few did, some on private property.
Huh.
So the clones that we had that were taken early days by Center for Plant Conservation Gardens, like the Arnold Arboretum, they were the ones with Ron Dieterman that took the first collections for safeguarding. We didn't know the sexes of these trees.
Interesting.
They're males and females, right? So just by growing them, if we could get them to thrive at the botanical gardens, perhaps they could start to show themselves. And we could figure out who is what. And we, you know, each clone is tracked back to the tree in the wild. So we began to learn about the sexing of the trees. What was left? How many mothers do we have left?
Yeah.
And then the Atlanta Botanical Garden was first, I believe, to get fruiting material. So then does anybody know how to grow these things from seed? Who's tried? Squirrels are pretty good at it. But the rest. Can we purposefully grow them? And so they did some intelligent tinkering, and it came down to a bucket full of water with the seeds and a drill with a bristle brush and scarification via metal drill bristle brush.
Oh, boy.
And soaking in that until it smells good and ripe, and then sowing them out. And then, of course, planting them underneath metal cages because so many critters take the seeds.
Right.
They lift the metal. They dig under the sides of the raised beds.
Oh, yeah. Tell me about it.
I missed something in there. Oh, it's terrible. They're so persistent.
Yes, I know.
The squirrels have broken many hearts at our botanical garden.
So. I'm not alone.
No, you're not. Solidarity.
Yes.
So we did learn. We learned how to make them thrive. We learned some of the things we thought they needed in the wild, some of the parameters in their habitat that they might need. And importantly, we learned how to grow them from seed. And, you know, all the trees that we'd been growing had been clones, had been cuttings from side branches.
Okay.
Nobody wanted to take the leader. the leader branch, the topical branch.
Right.
So they were all these amorphous, weird conifer, you know, balls of branches. But growing them from seed, you could see the lovely little tiny squirrel side evergreen trees. They're just so beautiful.
That's sweet.
And that was it. That was thrilling to see our first sets of little baby Tureas.
Wow. What an intense initial sort of learning process, right? Because, you know, as you mentioned, these are dioecious trees, so you have to get males and females in a population. And so those early days were cloning. Like you said, you don't know what you're cloning exactly, but just to get them to a point in which they could reproduce and then to try and figure out, I mean, that is just, that's intense right out of the gates. But it sounds like some of those early days were successes. And it is kind of funny that, you know, you're growing these things from cuttings, from side branches. And it sounds to me a little bit like they had a similar situation like they did with a lot of the podocarps and the Araucarias, where they don't necessarily revert back to a vertical growth. Sometimes right. They keep that horizontal growth and just grow into these strange, I mean, like the Atlanta Botanical Gardens collections of like Araucarias and podocarps look like garland, growing garland.
Yeah, they look squirrely. Oh, squirrely again. They look silly. They did look horticulturally fascinating.
Right.
We used to giggle about them, the big floppy things. And Hank Bruno, bless him, at Callaway Gardens, he tried to bonsai them into an apical dominance traditional conifer shape, and they just wouldn't. Yeah. They just will not. They do not revert. So.
Huh.
We embrace them as they were.
Yeah, that's incredible. But, I mean, ugly or not, or funny looking or not, you know, that was genetic material that was being saved. And if that can become reproductive, then you've done something really good.
And it wasn't that long that we had more known individuals in collection than in the wild.
Wow.
So, you know, when you're growing something and we go back and check them in the wild and can't find it, That's sobering.
Yeah.
It's very sobering.
I can imagine.
Makes for weekend watering ever more important. You're groaning about going in on a Sunday, but then you get it.
No, those are those moments where you're like, no, I have to get in there. I have to do this.
It's just, these are critically embarrassed on the roof. They rely upon me. So yeah, it takes your job up a few notches.
Right. Yeah, I mean, just to reiterate the direness of the situation, you know, everyone likes to quote that statistic that there's more tigers in captivity in Texas than there are in the wild, but how many plants does that ring true for, you know, tenfold? And I mean, here's a situation again where as recently as the 40s and 50s, these trees were super common. And today, you know, not that many years later, now you have far more in captivity from a handful of organizations' efforts to collect these. You have effectively outpaced what's going on in the wild. I mean, that just underscores how dire this situation was for this tree.
It was. And kudos to groups like the Arnold Arboretum for getting in their early days and tall timbers. Did somebody notice that Angus Golson, the amazing botanist, he lived in Chattahoochee, Florida. He certainly noticed, and he rallied help and got it. And people drove across the United States and put all kinds of I can't imagine the resources. We should tally it in hindsight.
Yeah, I mean, put a dollar to that, right?
Right? But we do it because it exists, and we do it because we may have played a role in why it declined, and it feels right.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're keeping all our parts and trying to move them into the future.
Right. And so during this time, did you get any inkling as to what may be affecting the trees in the wild? I mean, it sounded like it kind of remained a mystery for some time.
Oh, it did. And I tell you what, we were having, it's the timing was so interesting for us. We had had a year of meetings, discussions, debates at the Georgia Plant Conservation Alliance meetings about the commercialization of endangered plants. Is it a wonderful education opportunity, or are we possibly diluting plant population genetics? Are we causing some kind of harm to rare plants if we sell them, even if we bring that money from the sale of endangered species back to the recovery of the species? While we were having those debates, and we had written a document, we were going to take it case by case, and we thought we could produce and sell some endangered species as an education opportunity. And Turea was the godchild. you could grow an endangered tree in your garden, and it's a beautiful horticulture tree. So we thought we were doing so good. We thought, you know, teaching people, particularly in the Atlanta area, So that document never saw the light because we learned from Jason Smith at the University of Florida, pathologist brought in, working with Ron Dieterman, Jeannie Cruz Sanders, and other partners to figure out what this pathogen was. Well, he figured it out. We thought we were taking the terrae away from the disease. We thought this was in the soil.
Right.
We thought it could be introduced or always been there. Well, no.
Uh-oh.
It's in, I know. It's in the terrae. It is part of terrae. He named it, it's a fusarium named for terrae. It is in all of its tissues. It's passed from mother to child. And if the tree is healthy, everything's fine. They live together. But if the tree's weak in some way horticulturally, then this fusarium can express and it can spread.
Wow.
And in the lab, Jason Smith has learned that it can, he's done inoculations in the lab, that it can jump even in the lab to different plant families.
What?
So, yeah. So, you know, we had these conversations in 95, these triple promises that we would track and monitor and check for disease and plant in cultivated areas. But we brought the disease up here. We brought the disease to our botanic gardens. Now that our trees are healthy and we, you know, that is something we are very careful to track.
Mm-hmm.
But that means we brought the disease up here.
Dang.
So, no, the Georgia Plant Conservation Alliance is not going to produce plant material or share plant material for production because we don't know. There's so much we don't know about critically imperiled plants, and terrae is the example that we refer to. So we have been on hold for that for a good 15 years. So yes, we do sell pitcher plants. We have special permits for selling cultivated, ethically produced pitcher plants, trying to release the trait, but not the critically endangered ones, the
right.
common species.
Right.
So we've gone back to our partners, like Elachi Nature Center in Gainesville, and I said, you know that collection you planted 18 years ago and you as a partner, and we were so grateful that you planted that grove of terrae, and it is in a cultivated area, but it is next to your woods. You need to know.
Yeah.
And so now their board is, they still have them, but they had to go have a conversation about that. And if they decided that they needed to remove those trees, I would have respected that and understood.
Right.
Because they have a responsibility to the natural layers that they are restoring and protecting as well.
Yeah.
So, yes, the story changed.
Yeah.
And thank goodness that we did track them everywhere we planted, that we've tracked them, that we know who's who and where, and we know the health of those trees. And if we do see a problem, we would remove and burn that material.
Yeah. Wow, that is alarming. But again, a big shout out to this idea of intelligent tinkering. If you just went willy-nilly, went with what felt good at the moment and what kind of got everyone inspired without thinking and looking a little bit deeper, this could have been a much bigger issue. And right. And here's the situation where what ended up happening is so science fiction-y that it's almost impossible to imagine a scenario where you could come up with this on your own without having partners that looked into this deeper. And I mean, big shout out to the University of Florida in Gainesville for, you know, providing people that can figure this stuff out. But
it's beautiful work.
Yeah. The crazy part of this is that it's in the tissues of the plant, all the tissues, and it's something that it can coexist with, this fungus, right? This fusarium. But what's it doing in there? I mean, why would you have something that can coexist and then become pathogenic as soon as the tree gets weakened?
Yeah, how is this adaptive? Is it adaptive? Or is it just that they've learned to live? It's fascinating to think through.
Yeah.
So, you know, you're protecting two organisms when you safeguard them at your botanical garden? I know. It's very strange. Very strange and fascinating what could be. So a whole other realm of intelligent tinkering needs to happen.
Right. And the idea that, I mean, it sounds to me like this is a compounded issue because you have this potential pathogen living within the tissues, but something has to weaken the tree first, which kind of blows up this idea of like what was going on around that time period. I mean, you gave a couple possibilities of thoughtful possibilities, but what happened to suddenly flip that switch and all of a sudden these trees were just collapsing like crazy?
Right. I mean, that I can only imagine how shocking that must have been. I mean, it would have been rattling to your local soul because you grew up with this kind of forest and then you walk out there and all these adult trees are just dead. We have old slides of these giant trees with a, you know, a really good diameter, you know, a good, what, to 3 feet just down and roots up in the air. It must have been disturbing to suddenly see them change. And so it's like Dr. Seuss wrote the story. You know, I'm the Lorax and I speak for the trees. You go out there, you go hiking at Torrey State Park because it's what you do with your family when you get some time on a Sunday afternoon, and all the adult trees are dead. You know, that is such a Lorax moment. You know, you talk about a red flag in the environment. There's your red flag. Something is terribly wrong here.
Yeah.
That a 60-foot tree is suddenly not just dead, not a standing snag, but collapsed from the roots.
Poof.
Yes.
Yeah, and I mean, it's just this big call to action, I guess, in the context of how much our world is changing and the fact that we are pretty much responsible for most of it at this point. And you know, these issues with climate change and conservation, you know, that's not always this clean cut A to B to C. You know, you can't necessarily track all the direct effects. I mean, this is, again, a symptom of massive ecosystem upheaval and things that manifest that you can't even imagine at this point in time.
Well, and then what happened, right? Because there's more.
Right. What happened?
Hurricane Michael.
No.
What? It was a category. We thought it was a 4. It was a category 5.
Dang.
And it was bullseye Mexico Beach in Torrey State Park. So here are these Charlie Brown Christmas trees. You know, root sprouts of trees gone by, maybe some seeds that had survived in the seed bank. And now their entire forest is wiped out. They've gone from an understory tree, a tree that thrives in the shade of a ravine, at least in its first few decades. And now the forest is wiped out and it's pickup sticks, pine trees, and absolutely devastated. So partners in the Atlanta Botanical Garden rallied with other partners like at Alabama Plant Conservation Alliance at Auburn, the Davis Arboretum, and partners at Jacksonville Zoo and Gardens at the Florida Plant Conservation Alliance, and then state parks like Three Rivers State Park. They all rallied and rushed out there soon after the Hurricane Michael hit and tried to find the Torreya trees. They tried drones because there's 30 feet of piled trunks. And even you can't walk, you have to scramble, and then logs could roll. I mean, these are strong, dedicated conservation biologists. Kudos to them all. But they think that because they are Charlie Brown Christmas tree, because they're small, supple trees, that we don't quite know. We still can't get in there to see them all. But a goodly number did survive.
Okay.
And possibly because they had that supple ability and they were small enough to duck and hide. They did. With chainsaw teams, they spent several weeks out there trying to cut around Torreya trees. I did hear that Three Rivers State Park rallied resources and got in there and got the dead material off, and their park looks amazing.
Mm.
It's a hell of a way to thin your tree canopy.
Yeah, yeah.
But the plants, the understory there apparently looks beautiful. So they've turned a sad story into an opportunity for restoration. It apparently really, the diversity is remarkable.
Well, good on them.
Right? That was a lot of work. Oh my goodness, I can't imagine. So, Torreya, again, we go back. Well, thank goodness it's in safeguarding.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So we do have these backed up index collections. We know where they are. We know what ravine they came from. We could plant material back. We can. Once the site is restored, how you get 15 feet of toothpick trunks, I mean, you know, pickup sticks, that's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, pick up exactly. Trunks,
right? How you get all that material off the ground, I don't know. But someday, our partners, we could plant Torreya back because we have that material. So that's the hopeful news. That's the good news. But the ones in the wild, good grief. I mean, talk about kicking somebody when they're down.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
What a thing. What a thing that the maps, the hurricane went right over Torreya State Park.
Yeah, I mean, having gone to see this tree in the wild this year and seeing the devastation, the hurricane devastation, not just at the park, but in that entire area, I mean, that is just a whole new level of issues and hurdles to get over. Like you said, giant pickup sticks everywhere. I mean, Yeah, it's scary. And like you mentioned, they're supple. I mean, the largest tree I was able to see had a large branch sitting in its crown, bending it over. And like you said, thankfully they can bend and move a little bit.
Yeah. So maybe, you know, it's going to be really interesting looking back through time. Maybe that is an adaptation that they needed at the time and that will serve them well through this experience, this stochastic experience.
Right. And I mean, again, you're living in an area that is prone to hurricanes. It's not the first time one has blown through. But, you know, again, this compounding issue of environmental degradation, stressed trees, now susceptible to a fungus. And then you add, like you said, these stochastic events. It's almost too much. But the need for ex situ conservation and collections and preservation of living genetic material is just underscored throughout this entire story. Because, like you said, when and if and how, whatever ends up happening, you have some pieces to put back together once we can get some stuff sorted out.
That's right. And that's why we do what we do. We know that our first and best role in conservation is to protect and restore and manage plants in a wild setting. We know that. And that is a mantra that we in the Georgia Plant Conservation Alliance and our conservation partners live by. Our conservation work must happen in the wild. But we also must create these safeguarding collections for the critically imperiled, because it could be a hurricane, it could be hogs, it could be poachers, it could just be changes that they cannot adapt quickly enough to and they wink out.
Right.
So yes, having the seed banks, having the botanical garden living collections, the safeguarding collections in ground, in beds, in pots, carefully labeling them. It's a pain in the tuchus, but my goodness, aren't we glad? Aren't we glad that we were guided early in conservation to start doing this work and to amass these collections and to put the tinkering time into figuring out how to grow them ex situ so that we, just in case, God forbid, we lose something, we can put them back.
Certainly.
It's why we do what we do.
Right.
It is, yeah. Save all the parts. We try. Lord, we try.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. Ooh. So, I mean, obviously, you can't do much about hurricanes, but you can do stuff with these ex situ collections. I mean, what, since the early days and to today, you know, again, hurricanes aside, what kind of learning process has there been? And, you know, what does it take to make these trees happy so that this fungus doesn't suddenly become the enemy instead of just a passive hanging out, sort of living
right in? A guess that you think they're going to move out, but they live there for the next 10 years, yes. I guess that never leaves. You know, we could hedgerow these plants. We could grow them as hedgerows and know that the indexed individuals in that hedgerow, and they grow beautifully. It's a beautiful conifer. So they want some shade. They want some sun. Afternoon shade is merciful, and especially in the south.
Yeah.
But they can handle full sun for a while, especially if they're growing up in a full sun situation. The ones in the wild that are suddenly getting sun, you know, all this sun now, are getting sunburned. And we'll see how they respond to that after the hurricane. But a little bit of shade, a little bit of sun. We like to plant them on slopes because they want to receive water, but they want the water to leave. They don't want to be sitting in water. So they want quickly draining soils, nice quality soils. We're not planting them in our red clay. Mm, we're planting them in good, healthy slopes. And they thrive. They thrive on neglect. They just needed some place to grow. Now, why they can't happen in around Chattahoochee, Florida, you know, it still boggles.
Yeah.
You know, lovely soils there. The slopes are there. Light may have changed. Rain, I don't know. The paper mills are since gone. So it seems like, you know, if they can survive the State Botanical Garden in Athens, Georgia.
Right.
You don't water them. We don't, they grow, they do their thing. I mean, maybe in an extreme drought we would water them, but.
Sure.
That they can't thrive in the wild, there's a puzzle piece missing for sure.
Yeah, I mean, it is extremely intriguing to think about this plant that is, you know, I mean, it used to be abundant, but it was still a very narrow distribution. This isn't something that was widespread, but it is showing signs of being able to perform outside of that range, again, provided the conditions are given to it. So the idea that even something where there's a ton of focus given to it, a ton of attention, and lots of dedicated people, that it still holds on to so much mystery. I mean, that's the truth for all life, but you know, plants even more so, because they're not getting the attention that animals get.
No, but I tell you what, there is nothing like standing with a group of people, and these people could be 8 years old, 18, 22, 68, whatever. We stand and tell the story. We stand next to Terea, and we stand next to the weirdly shaped, wonderfully shaped Alice in Wonderland Terea clones. And we stand next to this beautiful little seed grown trees, and we tell these stories. And it is a great hook. Everybody is engaged. Everybody is fascinated. Everybody's concerned. And we'd love to say, so why would all these people invest all these resources into conserving one tree species and just let that roll around?
Yeah.
You know, and let them answer. And their answers run the gamut. But it usually comes down to because it exists. I mean, it is related to the yew from which they get taxol. It could have medicinal properties.
Sure.
Right? But we don't know. But it exists, so we work on it. But it's a great teacher. Terea is a great teacher for plant conservation.
Indeed.
From plant genetics, pathogens, habitat, safeguarding, stochastic events. It's got it all in there.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, that's a really good example of that. It's not that plants are boring. It's not that people don't care. You know, plant blindness is truly an issue, but at the end of the day, it's a matter, it's storytelling, right? It's getting people connected, and it's finding that hook. And the fact that people can stand there from all walks of life at all different ages and say, this is worth saving because it exists, that gives me hope, because the story of save it just because it's got medicine or some use to us, it's tired and it hasn't worked. I mean, it's good there part of that story, but it can't be the only thing.
No, I agree. That's perfect. That's right. You know, when we get our chance to tell our stories, people are fascinated. And our director of development, she's like, give me another story. People just hear. And we pride ourselves on being storytellers because, you know, we've got to. Right. We say we put eyelashes on plants, but we're doing whatever we can to get people to see plants. So that's our job. That's my first and best goal at a botanical garden, is to help people see plants.
That's a beautiful thing.
Yes.
So people listening obviously are going to care a lot about this issue. How can the average person help the Terea? What can they do?
How can they help? Well, that's a great question. Well, money always helps.
Indeed.
Money helps. And I will say, If donations could be had, I would say sending them to the Atlanta Botanical Garden, earmarking it for Terea, would be a beautiful, beautiful gesture. I know they spent many thousands of dollars out of pocket to do this monitoring and buy drones and organize, 30, 40 people to try to find the Terea after the Hurricane Michael. That would be a lovely gesture. It would lift up a lot of hearts.
Yeah.
Gosh, what else that can, knowing about plants, learn about plants, grow native plants in your garden. It sounds simple. It's not meant to be Pollyanna, but we know that putting native plants in our gardens helps all biodiversity. So contributing to biodiversity, make sure you're not buying poached plants or unethically harvested plants. We, on our website, have a list of recommended native plant nurseries. These people work hard to produce ethical collections, and we should support them. You know, a trillium should cost a lot of money because that's hard to grow.
Indeed.
So supporting that effort, that would be that is lovely. And being ever watchful for poaching, because it is an ever persistent, persnickety,
yes,
pernicious problem.
Yes, and often even worse for plants, because again, people lack that connection to them. The wrong stories have been told, and people think, well, why not? It's not really all that reactive. We should just dig it up and have a pretty thing in our garden.
Right. I've walked many conversations with people, and even people that they think they're doing good. Well, I went to the National Forest. I knew they were going to harvest those pines someday. No. Slow down.
Right.
Don't take it from protected land.
Yeah.
Please, my darlings. But I can't say that. We start walking and have a conversation, and by the end of our walk, they know differently about why those protected lands are so valued, and the beautiful management the Forest Service does on behalf of the National Forest. So, yes, poaching, even from roadsides. I mean, we put ourselves to very strict ethics, collecting seeds, even for conservation work. We follow the 10% rule, because that's good ethics, and we don't want to take everything from the wild. And
indeed.
And we hold ourselves to those restrictions, and that's for just conservation work. So we would ask everybody to have those ethical restrictions as well. But purchase your material. Purchase from propagated sources that do beautiful work.
Indeed.
That will help Terea. All those, they really will help Terea. And knowing Terea's story and valuing the last of the last. And yeah.
Yeah.
Knowing is important.
I mean, some of the best voting, quote unquote, we do in our society is with our wallets. So I completely align with that message.
Oh, that's good. Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So what's on the horizon? Obviously, you're still going to continue to work with the Terea and work to keep it on the landscape. What's in the near future?
You know, that's a great question. So we do need to figure out these trees are getting large, and many of them have been in pots for years and years and years, or raised beds for years and years and years. So we need to figure out a hedgerow system. Mm. And I think we're getting there quickly. We just need to locate secure places, appropriate places, cultivated places where we can hedgerow them and find partners. You know, hey, plant science is building on university campus. Would you accept a wonderful hedgerow of this index population of Terea? I don't know. We're braining that out. Where can we safeguard these? Because they are busting their seams in their collections. And they take pruning well. And we turn those collections over. We just start another cutting if the tree specimen gets too large. But finding some places where we could plant them in the ground would really help for their care. So we're working on that.
Excellent. Well, hopefully some people listening might be able to help with that. But yeah, Jennifer, thank you so much for enlightening us on this issue. And I'd speak for probably everyone listening that I am so thankful that you and the Georgia Plant Conservation Alliance exist, that you're doing this work. Again, with all of your collaborators, it can't be done in solo. No one has a monopoly on conservation, but thank you so much. If people want to learn more about you, your organization, and what they can do, where do you recommend they reach out and find it?
Thank you for those lovely words, Matt. It means the world. They can come to the State Botanical Gardens website, State Botanical Garden of Georgia. Just Google that and click on Science and Conservation, and you can read about the Georgia Plant Conservation Alliance, and you can also find us on Facebook.
Fantastic, and I will make sure to put up links in the show notes to this episode. But again, thank you so much for talking with us and for all of the work that you do.
Matt, thank you so much. I appreciate it very much.
Of course. Have a great day.
You too.
Cheers. Bye. All right, that is it for this episode. Great work being done to save this incredible tree, and I hope it offers you a little ray of hope in this sea of dismal outlooks. We got to remember that conservation successes are real. They're happening all the time. We just got to highlight them. It's good to know that when effort is put in, good things can happen. So thank you to Jennifer and everyone at the Georgia Plant Conservation Alliance for their work being done to save the Terea pine. As always, great things on the horizon. Make sure you hit that subscribe button if you're new to In Defense of Plants. But otherwise, check out those new Patreon benefits. You can go over there right now and listen to the first bonus mini episode. It's just bonus content to say thank you for all of the support that you've given me with In Defense of Plants over the years. It really means a lot. And like I said, if you're already in at the $5 or more level on Patreon, you're already added to that list. So just go over there and hit the listen button. And if not, go consider becoming a patron. It really means a lot. Also, In Defense of Plants stickers are back in stock. I know many of you have emailed asking about that, so head on over to indefenseofplants.com/shop and pick them up. And know that half of every purchase is being donated to the North American Orchid Conservation Center. But yeah, that's it for this week. Thank you again for listening. Until next time, this is your host, Matt, signing out. Adios, everyone.